in business suits or jogging outfits. Corey realized her own goth look, the streaked spiky hair, dangling metal multiple earrings and tattoos made her stick out like a sore thumb. What to do? She went into a bagel shop, ordered a bialy with lox spread, and sat by the window where she had a view down the street. If she could manage to make friends with someone on a ground-floor apartment on either side of the building, she might just talk her way into seeing the backyard. But you just didn't walk up and say hello to people in New York City. She wasn't in Kansas anymore. And then, coming out of the brownstone to the right of 428, she saw a girl with long black hair wearing a leather miniskirt and tall leather boots. Dropping a few dollar bills on the table, she bolted from the bagel shop and went walking down the street, swinging her bag and looking up at the sky on a collision course with the fellow goth coming the other way. It had been so easy. Now the sun was setting, and Corey was relaxing in the tiny kitchen of the ground-floor apartment, drinking green tea and listening to her newfound friend complaining about all the yuppies in the neighborhood. Her name was Maggie, and she worked as a waitress at a jazz club while trying to break into theater. She was bright, funny, and clearly starved for company. "I'd love to move out to Long Island City or Brooklyn," she said, cupping her tea, "but my dad thinks any place in New York outside of the Upper East Side is populated by rapists and murderers." Corey laughed. "Maybe he's right. That building next door looks pretty creepy." She felt horribly guilty manipulating a girl she would actually like to have as a friend. "I think it's abandoned. I don't think I've ever seen anyone go in or out. Weird. It's probably worth $5 million. Prime real estate just going to waste." Corey nursed her tea and wondered, now that she was here, how she was going to get outside into the patio behind the brownstone, get over the 8-foot wall into the backyard of the creepy house next door, and then break in. Break in. Was that really what she was going to do? For the first time, she stopped to think about why exactly she was here and what she was planning. She had told herself she was just going to check things out, casually. Was it really the most intelligent thing to do, contemplate a B&D, even as she was studying at John Jay for a career in law enforcement? And that was only the half of it. Surely she'd broken into more than her share of places before, back in Medicine Creek, just for the hell of it. But if Betterton was right, these people were dangerous drug dealers, and Betterton was dead. Then, of course, there was her promise to Pendergast. Of course she wouldn't break in, but she'd check it out. She'd play it safe, peer through the windows, keep her distance. At the first sign of trouble or danger or anything, she'd back off. She turned to Maggie and sighed. "I like it here. I wish I had a place like this. I'm getting kicked out of my apartment the day after tomorrow, and my new lease doesn't start until the 1st. Guess I'll go stay at a hostel or something." Maggie brightened. "You need a place to crash for a few days?"
"Do I?" Corey smiled.
"Hey, it will be great having somebody here. Living alone can kind of creep you out sometimes. Do you know, when I got home yesterday evening, I had the strangest feeling that somebody had been in the apartment while I was gone." Chapter 67. By 10 p.m., the wind had picked up, raising faint white caps on the dark surface of the Hudson River, and the temperature hovered a few degrees above freezing. The tide was ebbing, and the river flowed smoothly southward toward New York Harbor. The lights of New Jersey glowed coldly across the dark mass of moving water. 10 blocks north of the 79th Street Marina, on the rip-wrapped shore below the West Side Highway, a dark figure moved down by the water. It was dragging a broken piece of flotsam over the rocks, a battered remnant of floating dock, some planks of wood adhering to an abraded chunk of marine styrofoam. The figure eased the piece into the water and got aboard, covering himself with a rotten section of discarded tarp. As the raft hung next to shore, The figure produced a stick, whittled flat at one end, which, when dipped in the water, became almost invisible, and which subtly controlled the progress of what looked like a mass of floating detritus. With a small push of the stick, the man shoved the improvised bark away from the shore, where it drifted into the current, joining other random pieces of flotsam and jetsam. It moved out until it was a few hundred feet offshore. There it floated, turning slowly, as it drifted sluggishly toward a group of silent yachts in a mooring field, their anchor lights piercing the darkness. Slowly the flotsam floated past the boats, bumping against one hull, then another, on its seemingly random journey. Gradually it approached the largest yacht in the anchorage, knocking lightly against its hull and drifting past. As it neared the stern, there was the very slightest of movements, a rustle and a faint splash, and then silence as the now tenantless piece of garbage continued past the yacht and vanished in the darkness. Pendergast, in a sleek neoprene suit, crouched on the swim platform behind the stern transom of the Vergultung, listening intently. All was silent. After a moment, he raised his head and peered over the edge of the stern. He could see two men in the darkness, one relaxing on a sitting area on the aft deck, smoking a cigarette. The other was walking around on the foredeck, barely visible from this angle. As Pendergast watched, the man on the aft deck raised a pint bottle and took a long pull. After a few minutes he rose, unsteadily, and took a turn around the deck, pausing at the stern not 5 feet from Pendergast, looking across the water, before reinstalling himself in his nook and taking another long drink from the bottle. He stubbed out the cigarette, lit another. From the small dive bag he carried, Pendergast removed his less bare 45 and gave it a quick check. He shoved it back into the bag and removed a short length of rubber hose. Again he waited, watching. The man continued drinking and smoking, then finally rose and walked forward, disappearing through a door into the interior of the yacht, where dim lights glowed from various windows. In a flash, Pendergast was over the stern and onto the aft deck, crouching behind a pair of tenders. Thanks to his new friend, Lowe, Pendergast had learned there were probably only a few crew members on board. Most had gone ashore that afternoon, leaving, the general manager believed, only 4 on the vessel. How accurate this information was remained to be seen. According to Lowe's description,